Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Free Forum, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Andrew Bacevich about his newest book, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. And you can learn more at Quincy Inst. That's the word Quincy, and then I-N-S-T, like Institute, quincyinst.org. That's the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, of which Andrew Bacevich is the director. Now, many of you know that after a three-year hiatus with Trump's Electoral College victory, I began doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. A quick plug for participation. If you want to be engaged in being a citizen, some organizations that I think can lead you to relevant and timely actions, indivisible.us or indivisible, I think almost any suffix works, but indivisible.us, they have about 5,000 local organizations, and every week you get an email saying, you might call this, you might do this, here's a demonstration, here's a bill that's coming up. A couple that were primarily digital for years, but now work quite closely with the grassroots on a national level, moveon.org, that's M-O-V-E-O-N, one word, .org, or in California, couragecampaign.org. A couple that are specifically related to you communicating with your representatives is fivecalls.org. That's the number five in the word calls, fivecalls.org, which gives you suggestions of calls that might be timely and relevant, and Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are holding meetings with constituents back at home. And since climate change is such an important issue, I also like to say, if that's an issue you care about, check out 350.org. Now to today's guest. We're caught up these days with the Trump administration's assassination of General Soleimani of Iran and the impeachment trial over Trump's withholding of military aid to Ukraine in order to get them to investigate the Bidens. And not far off stage, stand Vladimir Putin and Russia, who meddled in the 2016 election and are actively doing so again in 2020. And here at home, we suffer social and political tribal conflicts, rampant inequality, ineffectual democracy, and an inability to solve big problems. Now think back 30 years, when the Cold War ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Washington establishment felt that it had prevailed in a world historical struggle, that our side had won a decisive and irreversible victory, that history, having brought the United States to the summit of global power, had validated American-style liberal democratic capitalism as the way forward. Now, I first interviewed today's guest, Andrew Bacevich, in 2008. His book, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, pulled things together in ways that I hadn't really seen before. Things like our politics of personality, the rise of the imperial presidency, our national culture of consumption, as well as how all of those linked to our military adventures. And I have paid close attention to his insights ever since. In his newest book, The Age of Illusions, Bacevich takes us from that seemingly ultimate victory in 1989 to the current troubling and chaotic moment, and attempts to explain how we ended up with outsized inequality, permanent war, moral confusion, an increasingly angry and alienated population, and Donald Trump. Andrew Bacevich, Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at Boston University, is a graduate of both the U.S. Military Academy and Princeton University. He served in the U.S. Army for 23 years, retiring with the rank of colonel. His books include The Limits of Power, America's War for the Greater Middle East, and Twilight of the American Century, and his latest, the one we're going to focus on today, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Welcome again, Andrew Bacevich, to Free Forum, a World That Just Might Work.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Okay, you are very welcome. And let me tell listeners that we are recording this conversation Tuesday, January 14th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Now, your path from West Point and a 23-year military career to the work you do today at Boston University in your writings and as president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, how do you assess that path? Were there, and kind of what I'm thinking is, were there quick turns, pivotal moments of decision, or was there sort of a gradual evolution?
Probably more gradual than a quick turn, but I think I would tell the story this way. You know, my military career spanned from 1969 when I graduated from West Point till 1992 when I got out of the Army. In other words, pretty much coinciding with the second half of the Cold War. And certainly by upbringing and by my professional experience in the Army, I had come to see the Cold War as the as expressing contemporary history. That's what history was about, was the Cold War, I thought then. As everybody else in the foreign policy establishment, I think I assumed the Cold War was going to go on forever and was very much caught by surprise when Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet leader, decided to call it off. Soon thereafter, I was out of the Army. Now I had a different perspective. I was looking at things from the outside, not from the inside. I was trying to pay attention to what would be the impact of the end of the Cold War, particularly on U.S. national security policy, but more broadly on the country at large. And what I came to conclude is that that moment of triumphalism, when we thought we had hit the jackpot, when we concluded that the world was now ours to define, I came to the conclusion, again gradually, not in one sort of fell swoop, that we misread the significance of the Cold War itself. We misread the implications of the end of the Cold War, and we succumbed collectively. But really talking about the people who shape policy, shape the discussion of policy, determine the ideas that inform policy. We did a victory dance in the end zone, bought into a set of deeply defective propositions, spent the post-Cold War period, that is to say, the period from the end of the Cold War to the election of Donald Trump, trying to implement those propositions, only to discover in 2016 that not only had they failed, but that a sufficient number of our fellow citizens had repudiated the post-Cold War consensus, signaling that repudiation by electing Donald Trump president.
Okay. And let me, one other thing about your path. You write for both The Nation and The American Conservative. And I checked, and you've published at both of them since mid-November. So it's not just historical fact, it's current. Do you know, first of all, if anyone else covers that range of journals? And how do you explain the fact that you can and do contribute to both of those and their different points of view?
Well, I'm a conservative, but I'm an anti-interventionist, even anti-war conservative. And the American Conservative magazine is an example of one outlet on the right. There are not many that are highly skeptical of our misuse of American military power over the last several decades. There are, in that regard, progressives and progressive publications like The Nation actually are far more accommodating with regard to my view. And so I can write in both places. But let's be clear, I'm not writing essays for The Nation on reproductive freedom, because there are issues where, as a conservative, I will be at odds with progressives. But I think my comfort zone really has to do with American military power, how we amass it, how we use it, and the consequences that stem from that use.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk first about the, shall we say, current events, and then back off into the bigger picture of the era of the Cold War and the post-Cold War that you cover in The Age of Illusions. With regard to the Soleimani strike or the Soleimani killing, you quote Secretary of Defense Mark Esper saying the game has changed, and then in something you wrote, you replied, except in a nominal sense of enlarging the target set, the game remains unchanged. Even if violence escalates further in the days ahead, it's a game the United States has been playing and losing for close to a generation. Could you expand on that, what the game is and how the game has not changed?
Yeah, so let me offer some context. And the context has to do with why do we, as a nation, why do we insist on maintaining such a large and powerful military establishment? During the Cold War, the answer to that question was, well, we need that strong military to prevent World War III. We need that military to contain the Soviet Union, to make sure that the Warsaw Pact doesn't overrun Western Europe. Now, there were other things going on during that period of time that resulted in the actual use of the U.S. military.
That's right.
Vietnam being the most vivid example.
Mm-hmm.
But the strategic rationale was to avert war. Post fall of the Berlin Wall, I think that changes radically. It changes radically without a heck of a lot of sort of national debate and discussion. When the Cold War ended, there was a very brief discussion about a peace dividend.
Yes, I recall.
There was no peace dividend. There was instead a broad agreement within the national security establishment that we would continue to maintain very large and very powerful forces. Indeed, maintain very large and powerful forces configured for power projection, not defending the homeland, and to keep them scattered in bases around the world. The big difference was that the overarching purpose of the United States military by the time we get into the 1990s is not to avert war. It's not to contain some adversary. Rather, the purpose is to put our power to work in order to try to bring about change, that the kind of change that we want. George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the last Cold War president,
mm-hmm.
and one could say very briefly, the first post-Cold War president, in a sense introduced this new approach to this new rationale for our military power by invading Panama in December of 1989. Regime change, get rid of the bad guy, install a new government more to our liking. And that actually, really a completely forgotten military effort, kind of worked. You know, the fight ended in 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
American casualties were minimal. And we haven't worried about Panama since. So to my mind, viewed in hindsight now, what George Herbert Walker Bush was doing was establishing a template that his successors, Clinton, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, then attempted to build upon, albeit, sadly, with quite different results.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
So
and, I mean, it's almost unfortunate that that first foray went so well, if you will.
In a way, but on the other hand, there were also episodes early on in the post-Cold War period where there were opportunities for us to say, hey, wait a second, maybe our forces aren't unbeatable. Maybe this notion of changing the way people govern themselves is going to get us in trouble. And I refer here to the Somalia intervention,
yeah.
which was ordered by the elder Bush, inherited by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton decided that it was not going to suffice simply to feed the starving Somalis and then go home. He decided that it was incumbent upon the United States, working with the UN at that time, to install a new political order in Somalia. That effort, of course, resulted in a very substantial blowback, leading to the famous Mogadishu firefight, leading to really the failure of that mission. I wish that our national security leaders had paused at that moment and said, hey, wait a second.
Yeah.
If we send U.S. forces into some crowded urban area where they are faced with not conventional forces in tanks, but fierce militias, highly motivated, willing to die for their cause, whoa, we're not very good at that. Had we taken on board that lesson of Mogadishu, perhaps we would have been less keen to jump into some of the subsequent wars in and around the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's setting up context, so the game that you say, which hasn't changed, no matter what Mark Esper says, is this game of forward projection of American power, of willingness for military intervention, military action, and in some sense a weakness of our diplomacy arm, and that ends up with this this action by the Trump administration in the killing of Soleimani.
Yeah, and but you left out one piece, and the piece you left out was we act militarily with the expectation of being able to achieve the political outcome we want. And so, you know, our wars in this region, I'm talking specifically about the Middle East and talking particularly about the post 9/11 period, undertaken because we believed that we had the capacity to determine what the future of Afghanistan would be, the future of Iraq would be. And I think that in many respects, that's where the Trump administration is today. They believe somehow that through the use of coercion, some economic, some military, that they can bring about changes in Iran that are going to give them the Iran they want. It has not worked very well. I don't think it's going to work in Iran. But the Soleimani assassination, in some respects so shocking, I think really deserves to be seen as a continuation of a pattern of behavior that goes back a couple of decades.
Yeah, I'm sorry I left that piece out. Yes, in other words, we now project forward and insert ourselves because we believe we have, I guess, the right as we still tell ourselves, the sole superpower, the democratic superpower, to impose our worldview, our political view, and so on other nations, and as you point out, the unsuccessful repeated
right and the capability.
Yeah, that we set out to do it. We've got this military we brag about before every football game and in every speech, and it's obviously going to win. And as you have pointed out, and we're going back probably to limits of power and certainly Washington rules. How long has it been since the U.S. had a victory?
Well, I mean, if the purpose of war is to achieve your vital, you know, political objectives, we haven't had many victories. A war that drags on for almost two decades, as the Afghanistan war has, with the prospect of achieving our political purposes nowhere in sight, has to rate as a defeat, a failure. And it astonishes me the extent to which there's so little willingness to confront that reality. You know, what was it, 6 weeks ago now? The Washington Post published the so-called Afghanistan Papers, which demonstrated beyond the shadow of a doubt that we were lied to. We have been consistently lied to by the people managing the war telling us that things are going well. Those people assigned responsibility for managing the war acknowledge that they had no idea what they were doing.
in those papers, in other words, what those papers reveal is that acknowledgement by them.
Which was not intended to, you know, to be revealed to the public.
Sure.
But my real gripe here is that was a big story for about 4 days, and now it's pretty much vanished.
Yeah, and let me see. It seems to me that what the Afghanistan papers revealed, and I think that's why they called them the Afghanistan papers, was very similar to what the Pentagon papers revealed. Now,
bingo.
And I have interviewed Dan Ellsberg, and he has said, you know, he assumed that when they were finally published, that it would change everything. And in fact, it caused much more of an upset than the Afghanistan papers by 100 degrees, but it didn't change much. And that was, I mean, he felt he failed. But the fact that the Pentagon papers, everyone knows about, we make movies about them, we talk about them as this moment in history, the Afghanistan papers, as you point out, last about 4 days as something anyone even cares about. How do you explain that?
But it's pretty easy, and the answer lies in the difference between Vietnam and Afghanistan with regard to the role of the American people. The Vietnam War was a war fought by citizen soldiers, conscripts.
Yes.
And when the war didn't go well, large numbers of American people got pretty pissed off. And we had anti-war demonstrations. We had an impact on our politics that caused members of Congress to reassess their perspective on basic national security policy. So today, the conditions for that kind of a debate don't exist. Because, I mean, to put it bluntly, the vast majority of the American people don't care.
That's right.
What's going on in Afghanistan. The number of American casualties is quite low.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only people we care about getting killed are Americans. We don't care how many Afghans are being killed or how many Iraqis are being killed or how many people in Yemen are being killed. We only take notice when large numbers of GIs are getting killed. Furthermore, and this is equally incredible, we don't care how much money is being spent. I mean, over and over and over again, we've been told in newspaper articles and in books that we have expended trillions of dollars on the so-called global war on terrorism with minimal positive results. And yet, that vast expenditure of treasure basically gets shrugged off. It's not a big issue. It's not a big issue in the approaching
election
campaign.
Yep. Now, but let me just point out a couple of specifics on that. In other words, I believe that the timeline is Afghanistan papers come out. There's a bit of writing about them. It dies in 3 or 4 days. And recently, the Congress passed the newest Pentagon appropriations of $780 billion. Which it's done almost every time by some progressive publication, but they will point out how many, what that could do for healthcare, what that could
do
for the homeless, what that could do for young people going to college, what that could do for childcare, what that could do to actually restore both the hope of Americans and the capability of America to thrive in this very different century. But then it fades. Each time that bill is up and when it gets passed, you'll get a few articles that'll point out what we're not doing with that money that we're wasting in the military.
The national security apparatus is brain dead.
Yeah.
The national security apparatus, and I'm using that term to mean, the Pentagon, the intelligence community, Congress, especially members on the military-related committees, the people who work in Brookings or the other think tanks, all these folks, virtually none of them have found it possible to ask first-order questions about U.S. national security policy. That is to say, virtually none of them are willing to ask the question, is it in the interests of our country to have national security policy be based on the notion that amassing military power and using military power is in the interests of the American people? It does that approach actually promote stability? Does it promote our values? Nobody wants to talk about that because the evidence seems to me it's pretty clear.
Oh, very.
9/11, that the use of military power creates chaos. That's what we've done.
It creates chaos. It creates enemies. And I mean, by the way, when you were talking about the Americans don't seem to care about other people dying in our military adventures, it's not just that. How about countries being wrecked? You know, I mean, whatever you may say about the countries we've intervened in, they are not better off. They are in chaos. Their systems are broken. And that, again, doesn't occur. Now, one question, which is, as I'm reading your book, as I'm reading your articles, as I'm thinking about this, is the accusation you make against the foreign policy and military policy establishment is, it's so clear. Why? Why so few? I know that part of it is always justified. Why Congress goes along with it is that many of the, you know, that the defense establishment, the military-industrial complex, has been smart enough to put money in every congressional district, you know, and so it's a jobs
right.
program. But that doesn't explain how people who have made it their you know, their cause, their calling, their vocation to care about these things, how they, and it isn't just that they're wrong, it's that, as you say, they don't even ask the questions.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about people who are inside the military, you know, they live, I used to live, in really an all-encompassing environment. You know, for me, I say this with considerable embarrassment and regret, for me, for a good chunk of my life, the most important thing was the Army, was the well-being of the Army.
Mm.
And being in the Army does not necessarily cultivate critical thinking. Not for a second am I implying that everybody in the Army is an automaton. They mm-hmm. just sort of salute and do what they're told. But it doesn't encourage broad-based critical thinking. And therefore, if U.S. forces, if the Army has been involved in a war since 2001 that remains unwon and perhaps unwinnable, the focused attention really is on, well, how do we do this better? You know, what are the new systems that need to be introduced into the battlefield that can give us an advantage over our adversary? What are the new tactics that can be employed that can help us win the fight on the ground? There is not, as far as I can tell, a lot of people asking about you know, whether or not the perpetuation of these conflicts actually serves the interests of the American people, and whether simply trying harder will result in a positive outcome somewhere along the line. That's well, part of the problem.
One thing that I'm struck by is you're saying that's within the military.
Right.
What's odd is that this isn't. It seems to me this isn't good for the military to be losing or treading water. Although there doesn't seem to be any cost to them because no one seems to care.
Well, they would not agree with your assessment and my assessment that they're losing.
Ah.
So how are these wars fought? You know, the Afghanistan war, now whatever it is in its 19th or 20th year, a unit deploys. It deploys for, you know, 6 months or a year. The troops show up. They say their mission is to, pacify this particular area or to train this particular set of Afghans. And the commander arrives on site and he assesses the situation. He says, boy, this is a mess. And then they work as hard as they can for 6 months or a year to make things better. They get to the end of the tour, and the commander submits a report, and the report says, yep, we're getting better. New commander then comes in, takes his place, surveys the situation, and says, this is a mess. And then, so this goes over and over and over again. So they don't think they're losing. As far as the commanders are concerned, on their combat tour, things got better.
So within their narrow focus, defined by geography or defined by some sort of metric, things are okay. Yeah,
they're winning. I mean, we never get to a conclusion. We never get to an outcome. We never achieve our political purposes. I mean, the initial political purpose in Afghanistan after we overthrew the Taliban was to put in place a legitimate government with competent security forces that could then govern Afghanistan, maintain the sovereignty of the state, so that the foreign forces could leave. And here we are all these years later. We're still trying to create a competent security forces. We're still trying to figure out what a legitimate government would look like. I mean, it's astonishing.
It is.
But on it goes.
Yeah. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich about foreign policy, military policy, and his newest book, The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. And you can learn more at Quincy Inst. That's the word Quincy and then I-N-S-T, like Institute, quincyinst.org, which is the website of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, of which Andrew Bacevich is the director and one of the co-founders as well, I believe. Let me at the second part of that. So that was why the military doesn't ask these questions, doesn't change, is because in each compartmentalized sphere, they think they're winning. What about this establishment? In other words, I looked at the experts at the Quincy Institute. There were names I recognized, names I didn't. But you are a hardy few, right?
Yes, we are. We are a hardy few. We got a long journey ahead of us because we need to change the way people in Washington think about our role in the world.
Absolutely,
we change the way members of Congress, congressional staffers, people who write columns for the Washington Post, and changing the way people think is really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me also point out that you, I'm going to jump back a little bit to the response to the Soleimani killing. And I'm going to read a quote from you. The Democratic members of the Senate and the House who whine about not having been consulted or at least notified in advance of the drone attack that took out the Quds commander deserve not a respectful hearing, but contempt. Okay. And then another quote. You say, in comparison with George W. Bush, who ordered the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and Barack Obama, who greenlighted the overthrow of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, Trump comes across as a small-stakes gambler. Talk just a bit about that, how it's tough to find the good guys in this.
Well, again, I think it's useful to review a little bit of history, and here we're talking about history of war powers. At the beginning of the Cold War, which coincided with the recognition that atomic weapons could destroy mankind, the people who were supposedly smart said that we need to empower the President of the United States to make war using nuclear weapons. Because only if the other side realizes that our president has that authority, it's not going to take a big debate. He's going to make a decision, and the bombers are going to fly. Only then will they be deterred from attacking us.
And the logic to that applies only to nuclear war, right? In other words, the reason you had to do that was because response had to be immediate, because we're talking about the time it takes missiles. But it doesn't apply to any of these other interventions.
Well, I think I'm on a different wavelength with you.
Oh, okay.
The notion of empowering the president then went beyond nuclear contingencies, and the idea that the commander in chief should have wide latitude in making decisions about the use of force became part of the Cold War approach to national security policy. And the result of that was that the Congress's role, the constitutional role assigned to the Congress, Congress declares war. That came to be seen as obsolete. We didn't declare war. We were trying to prevent World War III, and in due course, we then fought other wars that presidents decided to fight for the most part. Now, you could say, with regard to Vietnam, there was the famous Tonkin Gulf resolution of 1964. The president asked for a blank check to deal with the problem in Vietnam, and the Congress said, you got it.
Yep.
The vote was unanimous in the House. There were only two dissenting votes in the Senate. What was going on here? Well, the Congress was trying to make clear that the president had this authority. His hands were not tied with regard to how the Vietnam War was going to unfold. So that was the Cold War notion was we need to empower our presidents to wage war.
Okay, let me ask a question then, Andrew, because the reason that I had made that I jumped in and made the statement I meant made, which said that swift response was justified in the case of nuclear attack, but not justified in any of these other instances.
I agree with
that's
that.
What I was
I
saying.
Agree with that.
And
but the real point. The
why
real
did
point,
why
I
did
may.
Why did they? That is, what was the thinking that said, well, yeah, we do need it in this instance, but now we'll just apply it to every instance.
I think the rationale, briefly. Is that in order to ensure that the policy of containment had credibility, we needed to persuade the other side as to our willingness to go to war, even in a place like Vietnam. And empowering the president with that authority, this wide latitude, was one way of establishing this credibility. But the point I would like to get to,
yes,
and the real problem, is that even if that made sense, I mean, I think you can, I don't think it made sense, but even if it made sense during the Cold War, it didn't make sense after the Cold War. Cold War ends, Soviet Union disintegrates, Warsaw Pact disintegrates, we have no big enemy anymore, and yet the notion that the commander-in-chief should be able to exercise this wide latitude with regard to the U.S. to the use of force persists. That was where it was in one respect in which things went badly awry.
Yeah.
That is to say, after the Cold War ended, the Congress, were the Congress responsible body, should have reasserted its ownership of war powers, but that didn't happen.
No, and let's now shift, and I appreciate all of this, let's now shift to the book, The Age of Illusions, and just to set it up, I'm going, one of the most striking quotes, although I'd heard it before, but when I came across it, it just seemed so absurd. I'm going to quote you here. Futures, and it's from, this quote is actually from an article you wrote, An Alternative to U.S. World Dominance in the Globe back in August. But future scholars will enshrine the period between the fall of the Berlin Wall in November 1989 and the presidential election of November 2016 as the era of imagined U.S. global primacy. In 1998, this is the quote I'm getting to, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said it best, quote, if we have to use force is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall. We see further into the future. How did this new book, The Age of Illusions, happen? How did you decide this is the book you had to write?
Well, I guess primarily it was because I became increasingly sensitive to the sharp divisions in our society, caused in part by our misuse of military power, caused in part by the excesses of corporate capitalism, caused also in part by the what we might call the culture wars, you know, the deep disagreement over what moral tradition, if any, should somehow provide a guidance to how we define and exercise freedom. I found all those trends to be deeply disturbing, and I thought that it might be useful to try to write a book about it. And also, I should say that I came to the conclusion that, especially as with the rise of Trumpism, that we should set apart this post-Cold War era, this period between the fall of the Berlin Wall and Donald Trump's election in November of 2016. This is a standalone period. It has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. And the end is deeply disturbing and indeed tragic. So I wanted to tell the story of how we get from this moment of euphoria to this terrible division and the election of somebody who is manifestly ill-equipped to fill the office of the presidency. How'd that happen?
Yeah, so I get it. I get it. It's let's look upstream. Let's look back. Let's look at the bigger picture. How did we get here? Yes, I get it. One point you make in the book is that you note that you and Donald Trump were born just 13 months apart. And by the way, you and I just 10 months apart. I was born in 48. Yeah. And like you, my dad was at the time attending college on the GI Bill. You point out that for a time at least, for straight white men at least, of that generation, what it meant to be American seemed pretty simple. And you talk about the movie The Best Years of Our Lives. Just take a moment to sort of set that up, because I thought it was a great way of sort of painting where we were at that moment and where we could have gone.
Yeah, so this is the movie that came out in 1946 and swept the Oscars that year. William Wyler directed. Robert Sherwood wrote the script. Tells the story of three vets, pretty ordinary guys, returning from the war. The setting is just, a handful of months after the end of the war. And it tells the story of the challenges that they face in trying to readjust to civilian life. And they all are able to make that adjustment. And by the time the movie ends, you have a sense that these ordinary guys can now look forward with some satisfaction to a decent life in post-war America. But along the way, the movie makes the point, at least in my reading of the movie, that their expectations were actually fairly modest. Their expectations of what freedom would be were fairly modest. They didn't question moral traditions. They certainly were not enthusiastic about the notion of sending GIs around the world to fight wars for obscure purposes and that the wars that never ended. So I thought that the movie, I think that the movie captures something important about that moment, the end of the war, the beginning of the post-war era, and as a basis, a comparison to what we imagine the end of the Cold War would yield. It's a radical difference, and I think that the differences contribute to all the trouble that we've had since.
Uh-huh. And so we kind of think we've got we think we've got this unified sort of look at things, and it does seem, justifiable. We've just defeated the Nazis, and now there's another totalitarian regime. We say now we must stand off with them. We must keep them contained.
Yeah, we have to remember how quickly.
Yes. John Foster Dulles, right?
I quote an article that he wrote in the summer of 46. I mean, the war ends in September of 45. Summer of 46, John Foster Dulles, will become Secretary of State for Dwight D. Eisenhower. At that point, sort of a prominent figure in the foreign policy establishment, writes an article that basically says, we need to gird our loins for a long competition with the Soviet Union. They are the enemy. And it's astonishing when you think about it. Hey, wait a second. 9 months before, they were our ally.
Yeah.
Nine months before, they were crucial in our efforts to defeat the Nazis and to defeat the Imperial Japan. But the quick flip to the Cold War, I think, in many respects, had a disciplining effect. on our collective psyche. I don't want to overstate this. You know, in the 1950s, supposedly the conformist, you know, 1950s, there were rebels. There was a counterculture. In the 1960s, certainly, there was a counterculture. But throughout the period of the Cold War, by and large, Americans towed the line. They believed that the Cold War gave the country some purpose. And it's only when the Cold War goes away that there's no obvious answer to what the country is all about, and we go off in what I consider to be cockamamie directions, whether we're talking about political economy or military policy or culture, with Donald Trump as the result.
Yeah, one thing that struck me, although they were different, was that in both of these cases, and by that I'm saying the end of World War II and the end of the Cold War, things could have gone very differently. And yet in both cases, the foreign policy establishment very quickly has their notion of where things are going to go, and that sets the tone.
That is a very important statement you just made, and I think it is precisely accurate.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about, we've got about 10 minutes, 12 minutes. Let's talk about where we are now. And I'm going to grab a couple of your quotes. You say that the three overarching themes have led us in this post-Cold War, in the post-Cold War troubles that we've had. One is hubris. One is an exalted conception of America's historical role and the belief that the present defines the future. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think it comes down to the sense of triumphalism, which was so powerful. You know, the triumphalism played in Peoria as an assurance that the danger was gone and you can take it easy, Mr. Middle America. In Washington, however, the triumphalism came in a different way. It produced the conviction that the future was now ours to define, that we could put our power to work to bring about a new world that would suit us. And we tried to do that through economic policies. We certainly tried to do that militarily. And I think we tried to do that culturally in the sense of exporting a set of values that were very much at odds with the traditions of other people, and they reacted violently.
Mm-hmm. And you, at another point, you say that what's different now is that, and again, this is quoting you, first, the era of Western primacy, with the United States as the ultimate successor to once formidable European empires, has now ended for good. One. Two, the era in which the benefits of technological advance necessarily outweigh any negative consequences is now winding down. Two. And three, the era in which taming nature translates directly into human benefit has now run its course. Now, I've taken a big step back to quote you on those, but that's a big set of changes. This is sort of what I call the 20th century, the 21st century challenges that are different from the 20th century challenges.
Again, I have to say I agree, and I think part of the problem with our political leadership is that they're still absorbed with dealing with the 20th century challenges. You alluded at the beginning of the program to climate change. I may be a somewhat late arrival at this, but there's no doubt in my mind that is the greatest challenge we face in the 21st century. In other words, what ought to matter to the American people is not whether or not we can install in Kabul a government to our liking. What ought to matter to the American people is, what do we need to do now to forestall the worst effects of climate change, which are now increasingly visible right in front of us? But, and I don't want to dismiss the significance of of proposals, such as the Green New Deal. But it does seem to me we're spending a hell of a lot more money in places like Afghanistan yeah. and in the Middle East than we are in trying to figure out what would be a comprehensive response to climate change. There's a lot of talk, you know, a lot of chit-chat, and maybe that's positive because, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, there wasn't even much chit-chat. But in terms of political will to modify the American way of life, to modify our emphasis on consumption, to modify our demand for hypermobility, not a lot of serious thought being given to how that's actually going to happen, at least as far as I can tell. I know people write about that. I know people think about that. But it doesn't seem to me that their ideas and their concerns have fully found their way.
Well, or have galvanized enough energy and attention.
Galvanized is the right word.
So let me also say, I interviewed Yuval Noah Harari, the popular writer of Sapiens and Big History and so on, and he points out, and this very much, I'm saying this because it's so much in sync with what I just quoted from you, he says that the three biggest problems we face now, the real existential challenges, remain nuclear war, plus technological disruption, which we just, you know, we don't know what we're talking about when we say that, but the possibility lurks, and then climate change. And he says that those three, which are really the existential challenges the whole world faces, do not avail themselves of nation states or superpowers, that they demand global cooperation, global collaboration. And yet what we see, not just in the U.S. with Trump, but in Europe and elsewhere, in Australia, is actually people moving away from global cooperation because, as you point out, and that's why you go back to the Cold War in talking about the U.S., is that because we have delivered so poorly in the last 30 years, we've created this cynicism, this anger, this alienation, and so on. But it seems to me that is our big challenge. And the way I look at it is we used to have it used to be multilateral agreements, right? And you got your spheres of influence. And then Trump says, no, I don't like multilateral. I want binary just between two. I don't want to be caught up in these big things. But when what we actually need to be doing is transitioning to a really successful global cooperation, which in some ways the UN has never become.
Well, I am partially in agreement and partially not.
Okay.
I'm in agreement, certainly, that when we take issues like climate change, there can be no solution absent global agreement, buy-in throughout the planet. But, and this is where maybe I'm a traditionalist, it seems to me that nation states will provide the medium through which that agreement comes. You know, the United Nations was created in 1945 at a moment of great optimism that the UN would serve as an effective security arrangement or organ. That hasn't panned out. Hasn't panned out for all kinds of reasons, but not least among them is the fact that the five victors from World War II insist and will continue to insist on having a privileged role in the organization represented by their veto in the Security Council. So I think nation states are going to have to come together. I wouldn't for a second imply that is easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Obama, the now virtually destroyed Obama nuclear agreement with Iran.
Negotiated by five countries plus Iran.
Bingo. In other words, at a small level,
mm-hmm.
Was an example of how nation states can find common ground to address very serious problems. It's going to take cooperation on a far larger scale with more important things. But as somebody who believed that the JCPOA was a really important accomplishment and somebody who deeply laments
its
dismantling by Trump, that's the kind of thing I think that we're going to have to be able to do.
So it's nation states in global cooperation. Let me ask you one last question about that, and then we've got to end it. And that is that it strikes me that authoritarianism has some real advantages when confronting big problems that call for rapid pivots and mobilization, like climate change. What FDR could do to mobilize us in World War II, China can do any day of the week just because it's an authoritarian system. Unless democracy, and I'd say the U.S. And some others, but becomes a more successful force for good in confronting climate change, China may be who we depend on to lead us forward, save the planet in the process. But then it seems to me there's much more at stake because, we want to human society to survive, but I think at stake might be how that human society organizes itself moving forward after survival.
I have to say I had not thought about that, but I think what you just said is also very important. If it turns out that authoritarian societies demonstrate greater effectiveness in dealing with common threats, then authoritarianism is going to get a boost. And the notion of relying on these slow-to-move, sloppy sort of democracies, they're going to fall out of favor.
Yeah, and it strikes me, I mean, the way I put it is that we have not been, you and I, our generation, let's say, have not been adequate stewards of this democratic ideal that we inherited from the Enlightenment, and I think it's up for grabs now because exactly of the thing that we're just talking about.
I agree.
Okay, so again, thank you so much, Andrew. The book is The Age of Illusions: How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. The website is quincyinst.org. That's the Quincy Institute, but you just write Quincy Inst as one word, .org. For this conversation and many others, articles and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work.com. They are the same website. That's terrencemcnally.net or one long word, a world that just might work. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, and usually some good news. I usually try to make about half of them good news. Sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at those sites, including Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, etc. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell and Teddy Robinson in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Andrew Bacevich, and keep up your good work.
Thank you.